Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Real Talk Extra. My name is Mfon Edem, and today I'm going to be having a discussion on another movie, as we usually do on this podcast. You know, most times we've watched different kinds of movies and had discussions about different topics, but today's movie is a movie that is a topic that is quite familiar with a lot of people. I mean, if you've really watched a lot of documentaries, there is no way you would not have come across the name Charles Manson. And today's movie is titled Charlie Says. And Charlie Says is just, you know, a movie that takes you into the parts of certain aspects of Charles Manson's life and gleans into his relationship with some of his followers. And today I have with me Omonike Charles Benite. How are you doing this morning, Omonike?
Hi, Mfon. Hi, everyone. I'm good. Thank you.
Good. And I have Onyeka Onyekpe.
What's up, everyone? What's up, people?
Good morning. Good morning. And also joining us today would be Stanley Agu. How you doing, Stan?
Hey, thank you for having me here. It's good to have this discussion with everybody.
Great. Okay, that's great. Good to have everybody here. And in fact, it's like a full house this morning for this movie. First of all, I want to start with, you know, as we usually do, like, I mean, watching this movie, I'll start with Omonike. What exactly did you get with this movie?
Oh, I saw lost people looking for direction. I saw people looking for someone to love them, looking for sort of freedom from things that they are experiencing in their lives. And Charlie was saying the right words that they wanted to hear, the emotional connection they needed. Most of the young ladies, they were not poor. Some of them were from a middle-class family. Some of them, I don't think any of them were really abused, but they were seeking something. And you recall, at that time in 1960, it was the time of free love. So they were all seekers. And I saw lost souls looking for direction. That was what I kept seeing.
Okay. I saw something very dark and disturbing because, as Omonike said, she saw a lot of lost people. You know, 1967 was the what they properly call the summer of love, where a lot of things started, you know. It was the year, it was just before Woodstock happened, the popular, you know, annual musical fest. It was a time when there was a lot of racial tension in America. Segregation was ending. There were race riots everywhere. And there were people, young people, who I can say were the children of the World War II, who were opposed to war. You know, they were tired of what was happening in Vietnam. And so you had all these people that were coming together. It was like opposing tension. Right? You know, there was a lot of anxiety and tension in the land. So they called it the summer of love because music and drugs and everything just came about to help people let loose.
I think I got a little bit of both. I think both yours and disturbing and your Monica's parts where she said that was so. So Stanley, what exactly was your own take on this particular film?
It was a very interesting movie, Charlie Says. I would say that what I observed was the cult playbook being demonstrated by Charlie Manson. We've seen numerous cults that have actually surfaced in different places during that period. So we can call them fringes. And also, I also see this cult playbook being played out today as well. So everything is just resonating and how you can change someone's mindset and also kind of captivate the person to become a slave. So that's, you can see how Charles Manson was trying to do those things. And also looking at the environment, the social seismic shifts that was happening, like Onyeka mentioned, you looked at the hippies movement, how it all started. It just takes you back to that history of all the things that happened that tried to spawn the hippie movement, and also what the hippie movement has turned us to. They say we are the yuppie movement, we are the children of the hippies movement, and the yuppies are the young professionals, and how this has also changed our global perspective on how we are talking about inclusion now, because these people were people that were excluded from society, especially when they felt they could not. Sometimes it wasn't much about the parents. It was the movement going on then. People were revolting. So they called it the counterculture era. And everybody was trying to like, no, I have to do it my own way. It was about, you know, let us be free. Let us, we don't like this. You can't just subject us to the normal norms of the, then it obviously started from the American mainstream society. Then we now move to how this has now cascaded down to even how it has affected us ourselves today in the way we view the world. So it's a whole lot of interesting period, that period. And that during that period, and Charles Manson just showed one of those fringes of those movements. They were positives of those movements. They gave us good music, pop culture. They gave us, you know, like even had the likes of Steve Jobs, who were part of that movement. Oh. He came up with his own counterculture of dressing in a different way and talking and making billions. They say the rest is history. But so Charles Manson, in terms of that cult playbook, I saw how he was trying to transform people to become something else. And we see that happen today when a lot of leaders, politicians, even religious leaders also indulge in that playbook to turn their victims, transform them to become yes person. And you see that happen today where you see, even today in a lot of religious palace, oh, my pastor said, it's not what you say.
Charlie says, so you pastor see this says.
Being played out today. Yeah, so it still happens today. And I remember that I had one of my colleagues in the office. We had this argument, everything pastor say, pastor writes the books, pastor says the song. No, but that person brings his voice. And when you can question that, you are already subjected to that kind of playbook. Yeah, I think it's a very interesting movie. And I marked it as one of the movies that I would use in case studies, you know, especially when you talk of mind control. So very good.
The thing is, what I think I saw was a little bit of here and there, because I'm actually familiar with the whole story of Charles Manson and some of the things that he has actually, you know, the first time I hear of Charles Manson, the next name that comes to my mind is, you know, Ted Bundy. And then you hear of, you know, Sons of Sam's. The Sons of Sam, and it's a whole lot of, you know, serial killer groups and everything. But if you get into the heart of the story, then you start extracting things like, you know, cultism inside it, you find out. And if you understand a little bit of mind control, you see a little bit of that, you know, play out. But one of the main things is that Charles Manson on his own is known for, you know, having, when you hear Charles Manson, you think of a murderer. If you don't even know the real gist, you just think of a serial killer. But he is primarily known for something called, you know, the Helter Skelter, where he teaches his members about a race war.
Yes. So Helter Skelter was actually a term Manson used regularly when he was describing his impending apocalyptic war that was going to come, where he had this religious like view of apocalyptic events where black and white people will fight off each other. You know, at that time there were a lot of race riots, and Charles Manson himself was a bit of a racist. You know, he used to complain that blacks were sleeping with white women and all those things. So he said the time will come where white people will retaliate and start killing the black people, which will force the black people through popular militant arms to rise up and fight off and kill almost all white people. So he and his members were going to go and hide in a place, in a bottomless, what he called the bottomless pits, which was an abandoned mining site somewhere in Los Angeles. And they will stay there till the war was basically over. Then they will come out and rule over all the black people because he was the person that was sent. He was the person that was sent to come and guide them because black people couldn't rule themselves. You know, he popularly used to tell his members of the Manson family that he was going to be the fifth angel sent from heaven to come and take over. And the other four horsemen, or the four angels that were going to come, were this very popular band, the Beatles. So he said he was the fifth person that he was going to come and finish it up, and he had the key to the bottomless pits. You know, a lot of his teachers came from the book of Revelations in the Bible, the book of Revelations chapter 9. And he just kept mashing it mixing it with drugs like LSD and music. I just spilled up a whole lot of what I would just basically call trash. But that was basically what Helter Skelter was. He didn't actually call it the Helter Skelter movement. That was the term that was given to it by the lawyer that prosecuted them eventually. But he used the term a lot. He just said, you know, we're going to do Helter Skelter. And it was all a lot of nonsense, basically.
I think Helter Skelter, was it something from a song by Bob Dylan?
It was from a song. There was a Beatles song.
Helter Skelter
from that album called The White Album in 1968. Right. And, you know, he coined a lot of things. You know, he himself was an aspiring musician. And, you know, that's where he got most of all he did to push the people.
But what scares me most of all is that, you see, you find this kind of story now, like this whole ideology of Helter Skelter. You have somebody out there who goes and he starts telling a bunch of people these things. And as we see in the movie, they swallowed it hook, line, and sinker with no remains. They believed it. They were loyal. They didn't even question anything. And, you know, sometimes what bothers me is that we sometimes feel that, look, these people are stupid. That what is wrong with these guys? How will they believe such a stupid thing? But we have seen different cases, like, if you've ever heard of the popular Jim Jones, who, you know, he took a bunch of people to an island called Guyana and he just gave them something to drink and they all drank it. And, you know, earlier, you know, Stanley mentioned something like, he said, you know, mind control. And it appears that there is no limit to it. There's a particular model that I was interested in, because there's this guy they call Stephen Hassan, who was a member of the Moonies cult for like 40 years. And he has something they call the Bites model. It's just basically a model where people just, you know, they call it the Bites model, where people can just take over. They have this model where they first of all do behavioral control for B, that is bites, I, information control. And then they have thought control, emotional control. So these things is basically a pattern that they just use to hijack your mind. But what we noticed in this film, that there was this particular girl that was brought to Charles, and she came and, you know, he was naked and, you know, he felt he could just get into her mind. And I don't know if you remember this scene where she just looked at him and said, look, as far as I'm concerned, this is BS, and she just walks away.
And he actually got angry. Got angry and asked her to be sent away.
You know, please, just go. So, Monique, what is it about certain people that make them susceptible to these kind of things and others are not? Well, like, you saw the girl that walked away. So,
yes.
Why can't everybody be like that?
Okay. I'll start from when I read up about Charles Manson himself. He had been a criminal from when he was young, but he seemed to have this charismatic air around him. And when you say what makes some people susceptible and what's not susceptible, I think it's individual differences. Some people are just amenable to listening to authority figure. But some other people, they're always critical of what they hear. Which is why you need to teach people how to think, but not what to think. In this case, Charles was teaching them how to think, what to think, what not to think. You recall there was a scene where Leslie, they were talking about the new girl was talking about how she when she had a past. And Leslie said, we don't have a past. Mm. Our life started when we met Charles.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So it's repetition, continual. If that girl who walked away had stayed one or two more days, she probably would have changed also.
Mm.
And so it's repetition, continual. Mm. But she saw it. And you will notice that when this girl first came, Susan, when she first came, she was doubting a lot of things. You could see the doubt in her eyes. You could see the doubt in her face. And she kept looking. But eventually, with continual listening, with a continual relationship, she became a part of them. So much so that when she tried to raise doubts in her mind when they were in prison, she started vibrating and could hear his voice even in her mind, because her brainwashing had become total by then.
A forgeress of what Monica said, you know, most of the people that had come to that period, you know, like when I said the Summer of Love, you know, there was a documentary that was done by ABC, and they realized that most of the people were looking for something. They already had this emptiness, you know, this lack of purpose, but they had come to a time and space where they were seeking something other than themselves. And most of them were young girls who had slight issues at home that dealt with a lack of a father presence in their lives. One of the main characters in the movie, Leslie, or who was properly called Lulu, she was a very good, you know, student at home. She had a good home, but her dad had left the home, and she was just lacking something. As soon as that happened, she left the home and ended up with Charlie. And on further, you know, investigations when she was older, she was recounting back what happened. She said she just missed that presence of a father figure. And Charlie represented that, you know. So he used to get young girls, you know, that period, everybody was walking around holding hands, half clothes, you know, taking, you know, illicit substances, and they were always high. So Charlie used to go around with some of the other guys that were in the camp, and they would look for vulnerable young girls who were obviously looking for something more than themselves. And he would talk to them. He had this knack of knowing exactly what your particular issue was. You know, there was a documentary that came up regarding one of the girls, Katie. And she said that Charlie told her that, you know, you're ugly and I'm ugly. And we're the only two people in this world. So let's tell ourselves that we're beautiful and take it from there. And that thing just held that spellbound. And from there, he was able to get her to the camp. And he did all those things with different them. Each person had their own vulnerability. And he used to zero in, focus on it, and get it to control them and take them with him.
So I think charismatic personality is a standard for anybody who is a cult leader. But they still have some people who are able to just say, look, man, this is some BS. I'm not doing this. And they just walk away.
Well, like as I mentioned earlier, if we look at the environment, I think Onyeka and Monica have also mentioned pointed out to a lot of issues already. Why? But then, if you look at the environment as of that time, like Oyeka was saying, it's a whole lot of things that were going on during that period. This was, like I say, a counterculture revolution. People were beginning to think, look, why can't we do these things differently? And it was the mindset, and this can permeate into society. You find out that even before then, in the early 50s, you had a lot of things that were happening on global space. A lot of revolutions were going on. A lot of innovations were going on too as well. And also those things start creating some shift into society. You start seeing people feel, oh, I don't, must I listen to you? Can't I think for myself? So you could have a lot of people who would run away for different reasons. Of course, the home was foundation to create that enabling place. So some of those girls could have been people who were from divorced homes. Some could also be from toxic homes. Some could be people who just feel they are seekers. They just want to look for something better. Some people were beginning to explain their own sexuality and find that it wasn't conforming to societal norms. And felt, oh, let me go for somewhere. So there were a whole lot of people, and people were experimenting on drugs. They're beginning to like, man, I think I can have a lot more LSD. Then was the height of LSD. They brought in LSDs into mainstream. And so a lot were happening. And these characters that were in this movie, these girls, did show from their own background that they were lacking. They were lacking certain things, like, or were from broken homes, or were seekers. So it did give us a deep insight into the times of the hippies movement. And there were a lot of them like that in the hippies movement. It wasn't only just Charles Manson, but his own was more notorious because of how he was able to mind control these girls, and not even the girls, but the guys. There were men there too that they were being mind controlled. And it will start with stripping, you know, like we see, how to strip your identity, yourself, and look at the ego. How do you strip that ego and become much more altruistic? So it's my communal living, communal sex, communal eating. And it also started this vegan movement we are seeing today, all started with the eating.
Oh, really?
So, yes, it all happened, not eating meat. And also, when they called them the flower children, because they were wearing colorful clothes, you know, they wear bright colors. Now we see that in our dressing.
Yes.
And so it was a social experiment that was on the way happening. And of course, as I mentioned, the Charles Manson was also showing you some of the fringes of that movement. There were a lot of things that movement contributed to today, but that was one of those fringes. When you say something has gone rogue, that was the Charles Manson story.
Okay, let's just take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to talk about how this whole Charles Manson movement gleans into what we popularly refer to as wokeism. That's when we come back.
If you're going to San Francisco.
That way.
In Empire.
Diane Sawyer talks to Manson's ex-followers.
He was the...
And in these extraordinary interviews, they attempt to describe how their middle-class personalities were overtaken by Manson's charisma.
I seem to want more living out of life than what was expected of young girls at that time. Drugs, sex, you know, breaking away from the norm. I think that when my father left, I was desperately seeking someone that I could love and hold on to and call my own. He was like Christ, and he had the answers. For as twisted as it all got, you know, I really think that I felt that I had met someone that, by being around him, would have a positive change.
So we notice a couple of things in this movie. And like, if you look at the beginning, the early parts of the movie, when these girls start coming around and people are being introduced to Charlie, and then you see them say things like, you know, you have to let go of your ego. You have to say, you have to, you know, debts to yourself. And you have to be enlightened. We see buzzwords strewing around. And if you move it from that time to these times where you have what people normally refer to as New Age religion, I think some people refer to it as that. Some people may refer to it as enlightenment. And you have other people that refer to it as being awake, or they say you're being woke. Or I've popularly heard word like wokeism on some right-wing media. And I've even heard one in recent times, I heard somebody refer to it as Woko Haram. I'm serious. I can't make this up. So as in when they want to. And you know, sometimes these things are used as like loaded languages where people just, you know, they say one word. And once you hear it, it's but we look at where this thing actually like we hear some of these things. Stanley, you want to give us a little bit of, do you have any idea exactly how that thing could have linked to some of this New Age religion that is popular today?
Yes. Like as I also mentioned, there's very good interest in the aspects. Like as I mentioned earlier, it was a counterculture movement, and one that was also counter to the Judeo-Christian religion, you see. And people were beginning to ask for, look for things like spirituality, where we are, who we are, and trying to ask and challenge the normal norms of society, religion. So this also, if you, in 1969, during the Woodstock Festival, there was, it was managed by something called the Aquarian Exposition, looking at the Aquarian Age and how this new form of thinking is beginning to shift. And we're beginning to see it happening if you look at, what is defining this age? And an age, like we say, is 21,000 years. That's when we move to an age. And this is the age of enlightenment. That's the Aquarian Age. Yeah, we are now in the age of enlightenment. So those counterculture movements did create the same movement today. We're beginning to hear the likes of Eckhart Tolle. We hear him talk about how to be in the present moment. You begin to see the likes of popular Sadhguru. We've seen people like the Antonio de Mello. These are people who are beginning to talk of the Enlightenment. So they've been, this movement has started a long time. Even the religious palace, there are people who have been talking about this Enlightenment, about knowing yourself, understanding yourself, being self-aware. We talk about the role of emotional intelligence and how it's about self-awareness, social awareness, how to control your emotions. All these are all part of that movement of Enlightenment movement. And actually, this period, the culture of that time, the counterculture of the hippie movement was part of creating this Enlightenment drive. And today it is not taking mainstream fully. A lot of young people, millennials, are not thinking about religion. In fact, it's like the Bible is beginning to sound like so much fiction and stories. And now they're beginning to ask for other things they want to see. So it all started from that moment. Although you would have had the early people who were talking, in terms of, we go back to history in the Scotland, then during Adam Smith, when we had the moment, the Enlightenment era. It all started those period, but it was slow. But then these guys took it into mainstream. The Woodstock movement took it into mainstream. And today, it is now becoming, if you put all the forces together, we are in the Enlightenment age. And if you look at the role of artificial intelligence, you look at the role of cloud computing, we are moving seriously into that age. So it's a very good, we can hold that as a historical flashpoint to show how we're moving into that trajectory.
Yeah. Okay, so it's apparently, the reason I ask this is because, you see, if you look at, I don't know if anybody has seen the movie they call The Chicago Seven. And The Chicago Seven... Okay. So The Chicago Seven actually is another part of history that gleans out of the Woodstock movement. And so you see two factions. And then you have the faction that believe that, oh, we just want to have a concert somewhere, gather a lot of people and commit fornication in public and all of that. Then you had another group that they were still rioting against the war, but they were sort of like a decent kind of group that would point fingers to this group that seems to be, be a counterculture thing. And sometimes, like you did mention the new people, like, Eckhart Tolle and Sadhguru and some of these new guys who have been, talking about this new age religion. But when you listen to the media, is it the same? This religion that we're talking, is it the same thing as being woke, awake, or wokeness, or Woko Haram, whatever? I'm trying to figure it out, really, because the language I mean. Because when I've had a debate with you one time, and you told me that I think it's sounding woke. So I want to know if it's the same thing.
I think Stanley, sort of broke it down perfectly when he said it's counterculture.
Why is it a bad thing?
It's not a bad thing, but when the culture is changing, when there's a huge shift in how the norm is or how society goes about its daily activities, it creates a certain imbalance. The people who are wedded to the idea of how things are, how things should be, and those who are looking to bring about something new, it creates this certain rift and imbalance in society. And it leads those that are on either side of the divide to give each other names, if you look at it, like the history of the hippies and all these things, well, this was a time not too long after World War II. World War II led about to women getting more rights to when it comes to war factories and working in places, because the men normally shot out to women before. The young adults in the 60s were children of women who had finally started coming into their own. Women who are started working for their own living. So the balance of the family had changed. Long gone was the time when your dad would go to work. Maybe he was a salesman, or he worked for a company like Ford or somebody, and your mother is at home, knitting and watching a TV show. You know, now your mom goes to work, your dad goes to work, you have the opportunity to go to university. So you start questioning the things that were taken as facts. You start asking questions. And, you know, you start, it's like you're awakening, you know, as they say. You're becoming more aware of the things that you weren't normally aware of. You know, before your idea was, okay, I've got to marry a good man that has a good job. But now you are that good person that has that good job. So the way women were getting more, getting into their own space, have been given the freedoms that they had always deserved because people were now working more. More women were being needed in industries and co. So that whole general shift led to the children of these people coming out and looking for answers to things that they normally wouldn't have questioned. You know, this is, my mom is going to work, my dad is going to work. Maybe the man now, because he's no longer the head of the household completely, his wife now maybe earns as much as does or out earns him. He loses significance. He doesn't feel as powerful as before. So there's a rift in family. So it started, I was unheard of. But now divorce was not commonplace because now most women will say that maybe they were just getting married because of financial security. But now they're financially secure themselves. So they could look inward more. There was more introspection in that period. And that's why they call it, you know, being woke and being countercultural. And so if you bring it to our age now, when I have children of people who don't know what a VHS tape is, or who don't know what a VCD is, or who don't know what a TV that doesn't have, you know, a touch screen is. You know, so many things. You now have people who have a totally different mindset to what we had when we were growing up. So they're bound to ask more questions. They're bound to look at things that we normally accepted as normal. This isn't right, or this sounds strange, or why is it like this when you can do this? And all those huge change in how things are done in the culture and society. The people who are spearheading the change, or the people who are the inheritors of the change, end up changing things totally. And for those who are wedded to the status quo, it leads to a rift. And that's where this whole wokeism thing comes about.
That was a very long explanation of woke. I was just, at some point, I'm like, okay, what any take on this whole, you know?
Because, well, to my mind, the first time I would hear the word wokeism used in that context was on social media. And I felt it represented, being aware of new things, not being taken for a ride, and or trying to get rid of old values. So when people use it, they use it in a derogatory manner. This woke generation, they don't want to respect their elders, they don't want to take care of their parents. So you hear it's wokeism that will not allow a woman to stay in marriage for long. Our mothers did this, our mothers did not do that, and everything. So it's on social media. So for me, wokeism is not really about religion. It's about people becoming more aware of things they would not take. Women, men, I say, look, yeah, people took this because I needed to be beholden to this person. But now I'm more empowered. I don't have to take it. So if I'm with you, I'm with you because I choose to be with you. So that's the whole idea that I have about wokeism. So it's not really about religion. It's about being more aware of your rights and insisting that you get them as you should.
Okay. I think we just had to talk about that because, you see, yeah. I noticed that we have this whole thing in this movie that actually represents lose yourself, your ego. They even had a particular scene where they are taking communion and, in terms of LSD and all of that. And sometimes when they say these things nowadays, and we talk about wokeism and, you know, the whole wokeness, and in America, you see right-wing media versus left, the left right-wing media refers to the liberals as the woke generation, the woke crowd. And I think in our own culture, we have borrowed it into most of all this whole ideas. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we will actually talk about the cult leader and see exactly where he contradicts himself.
I was cutting off my past, and in my own brain, it was like, I can't go back.
you could absolutely not talk about your past at all. And one thing we didn't have is watches. The whole idea was to let time disappear. There was no time.
So welcome back, everybody. And we are still talking about Charlie Says, and we noticed the aspect where Charlie is able to control a group of people's minds, is able to tell them to go and do some very egregious things, which actually this movie just, you know, pins a little bit off. But as much as we've spoken about, you know, wokeism, what kind of people are susceptible to these kind of, you know, mind control and who is not, and what kind of gaps that need to be fulfilled in their lives. But I want to ask a question with regards to the cult leader's intention now, because sometimes when I listen to stories about these cult leaders, I look at people like Jim Jones. I ask myself at the background, what was the grand scheme of things? What were you trying to achieve? It clearly appeared that it was not that you wanted to take these people to heaven. So I ask myself, I say, what was Charlie actually about? What was he trying to achieve? What do we know about this? The movie tells us that, oh, he was trying to be an aspiring musician. Now, the part that confuses me is that between the helter-skelter and being the aspiring musician, was the aspiring musician the main primary purpose, and then the helter-skelter was just, you know, something he was using to cheat people or use these little girls' heads to achieve his purpose?
Okay, it's very interesting to look at this, to want to dissect the mindset of a cult leader. The only thing I can say is that we can't really say for sure what is really going on in their minds, but we can make some very good prediction regarding that. But one thing I can say about what maybe aroused these cult leaders, especially even like the likes of Charlie Manson, is power. The ability to lust for power. When you are charismatic, and people kind of tend to romanticize you in leadership, we call it romanticizing leadership. And if you don't have that humility in you, you could get so intoxicated with this power, because you could see your own fellow human being acting like a fool in front of you, and you could play the mind game and control them. You see it even in some pastors or religious leaders today. You see them moving in, kind of try to become like demigods. And you see people waving, idolizing them, and not being able to see even their own fault. So this is about the crave for power. And because they know definitely they are just giving BS and nothing is going to happen. But they like that thing of being in control and being able to make people do their biddings and, you know, feel they are like something superior. So I think for me, that's one of the, and you know, power gives a bit of in your brain, in your dope, it's like a dopamine effect. It's like taking a high level of drugs, you know, only few people can actually experience it. So if you have that, yeah, you can. So these guys are on a different level. You can see people, celebrities also go through the same moments too as well, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. they see people mm-hmm. idolize them, worship them, mm-hmm. as and it gets into their, it increases and amplifies their ego to another level that mm-hmm. you and I have not yet experienced. So it's a different level of power. When you taste it, it can corrupt the mind absolutely.
I think it may be like a shot. You taste a little bit of it, and then you feel, look, man, this is so good. I just have to keep riding this thing, because I feel there must be a point where you feel like that you see, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't, because if you find that, we have heard a lot of cult leaders say a lot of things. I have heard different versions. There was a time in my life I used to watch documentaries on different kind of cults, and it's just endless. At a point I thought I knew all of them, and then all of a sudden I mm-hmm. see another one.
Something
another
new.
One, a new one comes up. I'm like, what is this? I've heard of
just
one that
like
told
Stanley
them,
said,
he told them that
to
he wants
the
to,
mind of a cult leader.
There was one that he's that I think he told them he wanted to take them to outer space, or a ship was supposed to come, a spaceship was supposed to come. And the fearful aspect of this thing is that you have people that latch on to these words. We had somebody like, is it David Koresh, who told his members that he told his member, David Koresh told his members that they should not sleep with their wives. That he was the one that was God-given and ordained to be the one to be sleeping with their wife. And people fell along with these things. So if we're talking about fire and power here, we're talking about a very, very dangerous type of power, very dangerous type of control that should be worrisome.
Yeah, I personally believe that. I think the main issue is that power is if you're not someone who has his purposes and who has his mind set on the proper things that should be done to serve people. Anybody that takes power, especially when he takes power over people where you have absolute power over another human being, I think is the headiest form of drug ever, which is why there are so many instances, in so many religious texts where they say power, where they seem to say power is an issue, you know. We have to understand that Charles Manson was a career criminal that just came out of prison in 1967 itself. And when he came out, he saw all sorts of young people looking for direction. And he was like, oh, he saw an opportunity. You know, he learned how to play the guitar in the prison. He saw an opportunity to play on their sensibilities. You know, everybody was looking for where they could just listen to music and get high and have sex cheaply. And he saw an opportunity to mix everything up together and get people to follow him. He broke them down to where he wanted to break them down. Then he got them to commit petty crimes, all for his purposes. I mean, when he was giving them drugs to take in the form of a communion, given that he used to pretend to be Jesus Christ at times, he used to put the drugs in their mouths himself, give them the amount of dose that would take them beyond where they could control themselves, while he would take very little for himself. You know, he was an opportunist, and it was just about him enriching himself and having people he could use to live the way he wanted to live without being responsible for any of the actions that would be taken by them.
Yeah. Mfon, can I interject into what...
go ahead.
If you don't mind. I just want to go back to... also, if you look at these cult leaders, they prey on the ignorance of people, you know, and ignorance is, according to Socrates, this is 430 years BC, so that ignorance, there are two things that rule us, you know, we say good and bad. The good is seen as knowledge, the bad is seen as ignorance, it's seen as evil. When people are ignorant, people can capitalize on that because you don't know. Leave the fact that ignorance is a bliss. Sometimes things you don't know don't hurt you. But when you are ignorant, and I want to draw back to what Monique said in where she was talking about when Charles Manson, obviously he has been power overdosed or intoxicated. First, he could stand naked and entice that young lady. And the lady said, you are the kind of people my papa told me not to talk to. Mm-hmm. See, she was able to show a bit of home training, and she brought in critical thinking. And it was about critical thinking. I know we did mention critical thinking in Big Short movie. We talked about how it's becoming one of the most increasing importance in terms of skills in today's world, even by the World Economic Forum. And it just takes me back to one time I was on the bus in London, and there was this young girl, she's about 2 years old, with her grandma. Then we're riding on that bus. I was just sitting beside, and this guy kept on asking, "Grandma, what's this?" The man, so that is a sign. Said, "Why?" She keeps on asking the why question over and over again. Now, why question is critical thinking. If you're in an environment where people can't allow you to question, then know that something is wrong. And that is the first point of call to say, something is wrong here, because you are trying to conscript my voice, and my voice is the only thing I have. So we have to be careful as individuals, as people, that when you are in a place and your voice is not heard and people can't allow you to say something, then know that something is wrong, that you are probably in the wrong place. So critical thinking helps us to, you know, if these people, if you watch even in the movie, when the lady, the teacher was also talking to them, I said, why didn't you question? Why did you ask? How did you feel you're going to be a winged elf? Mm-hmm. Are you okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You begin to cry. And she said, why? Why? It was the same why.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, so a lot of people, sometimes we have the power within us, but sometimes a lot of people just feel they don't want to exercise that power. And because sometimes ignorance is also a factor.
I agree that we have the power. We do have the power. You know, in that movie, there's something that actually I felt very strongly about. There's this particular scene where there's this guy who is in love with Lulu. She comes and he wants to take her away. She says, look, come. Can we just leave this place? You're under some kind of spell, you know, and everything. And then, you know, Charlie opens up his hands and says, look, you're free to go. And then that thing is also now, you know, it's actually reprised at the end of the movie where you find out that they give you a different version of what it could have been if she just walked away, which means that nothing would have happened. And this is the problem we have with people who are locked into some kind of mindset, listening to somebody, going to some kind of church where they are flogging you and pouring fuel on you, and you still don't want to leave at the end of the day. This is the issue that we know that the facts are there. You are free to stand up and walk out and nothing will happen.
But if you not pay attention to what he does a lot of time, a huge trick of what a lot of cult leaders do is to focus on getting people to make affirmations or to repeat certain words that end up stripping their agency away from their actions and giving the person all the power. You know, they say that repetition is a law of deeper and lasting impressions. You know, it's a form of hypnosis. You know, a lot of times there was a scene in the movie where one of their members, a male guy that had left, Tex Watson, he had left the group, then he came back. And, you know, he had given himself back to Charlie. And Charlie was acting a scene of when he's teaching them how they're going to go and kill people or kill what he called the piggies. And he was telling them, he kept saying, will you kill for me? And they said, will you kill for me? Then he changed it slightly to, will you allow me kill you? Will you die for me? And they kept saying they would die for him. And, you know, after you go through that process over and over and over and over again with so many other things underlying the surface, you find out that you have actually locked yourself into a pattern that you can't break out of. You know, so in the movie, he tells Lulu that she can leave. He opens up his arms and tells her that she can leave. And she looks at him, but she knows deep down that she can't leave because at that moment, she's wholly and solely his to do as he likes. And so she stays there. And as soon as that scene finishes, he takes her to a cliff and tells her that the only way she'll leave is if she drops down the cliff. You know, so he still punished her.
In other words, it's when she dies.
That she's free. You know, so he reinforced the message that he had been planting in her mind, dead to ego, dead to self. We are only for the community. Everything we do is for other people. You know, in the Manson family, the women couldn't eat when the men were eating. The men had to be served first. All women were available for all men for sexual favors. Any of the guitarist people that used to wander into the group, he'll tell the woman to go and service the men. Anything they want to do, they will do. You know, so he stripped away all their agency to the point that they get to where anything he tells them to do, they will do without question.
Yeah, I just want to also add in terms of using the BITE model. I was trying to say that, yes, I was aware of the BITE model. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the BITE model, information is what is first of all controlled. And that's part of the ignorance I'm trying to say. If I control the information, then you become ignorant. Yeah. You can't think. And your thinking is the only thing that controls your emotions.
Yes.
And then I control your thinking as well.
And
then
that,
when I get you to the emotional aspect, then even in marketing, in building rapport with people, it's at the emotional level, not really at the thinking level. When you can engage somebody at emotional level, you have already won the person over. The thinking people can think differently based on their mindset and their mental models. But then It is about, so when you use the behavior, you start conscripting the behavior, they can't move out. So behavior comes in. They are in communal space, and they start showing them things about being communal, going away from your self-identity to others. And you saw the aspect of the stripping that girl naked to make her understand that she has to sacrifice the ego and part of the community. That information.
Yes.
He made sure he controlled all. So that is, we're looking at the cult's playbook here. Information was now kind of controlled. You can't listen to all those things, bond all these things.
Read it only the books that Mao I write. China.
Only the Bible did it. They burned all their books. They burned all ladies because you have to control. Even in today's certain churches, they tell you, don't read this, don't listen to this. It's all part of that information control. Okay. Then they now get into your thinking. They not to play how you think, the way you reason. So, of course, you can't bring in critical thinking. It's not that at the altar of thinking.
Yeah.
So it's about, because critical thinking is about looking at other alternatives and evaluating them and coming up with the most best. So when you can't give somebody to think of alternatives, you must think this way, that way, and only this way. This is the way we think. And once that is done, I'm already caging your ignorance on another level. Then, of course, emotions is something one can toy with. Because when you get angry and you are highly angry, it impairs movement or thinking to your executive functions. You can be a beast because you're emotionally hijacked. So you see, at that neurological level, anatomy-wise, you can see how the whole information plays. So that means once I can engage you emotionally, and I know I can control your thinking, knowing fully well that your thinking is the only thing that controls your emotion, then I've already engaged you.
There's something else he also used extensively, the power of shame.
Yes.
He made them, he made them reveal their innermost secrets to him. And then so, once they have revealed those secrets, he has the power over them to use it as he likes. And then, you recall a scene where they were by the fireside and he just opened. Okay, yeah, they were in the house and he says, oh, this person said that this guy doesn't give head well. And the next breath, he said that we have no secrets here. We share everything. And then he started giving the guy a tutorial there and then. You could see the shock on the guy's face. You could see the shock on all of them that, oh, this thing was shared in confidence. And here it is in the open. So he made very good use of shame so that when your shame is exposed, you feel you are beholden to him. He has you in his hand, his power. He was a full cult leader.
You know, shame is linked to vulnerability. Exactly. You know, shame is linked to vulnerability. And vulnerability is a very deep place, and a place that most people don't like being at. So, he's able to capitalize on that.
Yeah, he capitalized and left them.
It's all in the cult leaders.
Yeah.
They have the playbook.
The playbook is there, actually. That is why I mentioned, you know, we talked about this Stephen Hassan model. That Bites model, basically. I think he's one of the richest. He was a member of a cult for 40 years, the Moonies cults, and he was able to come out of that cult. I can't imagine anybody have been a member of a cult for 40 years and you were able to still come out. That is a huge chunk of your life. So he now has written books, and he basically came up.
Lifetime.
He cool came lifetime. Up, yeah. So he came out with that playbook and was able to tell you that if you can identify, I think it's very rich. Even under, you know, Bites, is that like the T part is under, that is what they call thought control. And you see all sorts of things there where you talk about repetition of something to get into your subconscious mind. If you look at the movie, you remember the part where it says, pig, 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 kill the pig, kill the pig. They keep repeating it when he's trying to, you know, enchant them into going to commit egregious murder. Yes, I did. So at this point, we're just going to take a little break and we'll be right back.
Squeaky Fromm was another young girl with parental issues. Charlie found her weeping on a bench outside Venice, California one day, introduced himself as the man who's called the gardener, because he tends to all the little flowers at Haight-Ashbury, and that she should come with him, and she did.
Sometimes he would reenact the crucifixion when we were on LSD, and it was very realistic, and then make the connections of man, son, son of man, you know, and then the questions would begin, would you die for me?
So in general, how can somebody protect himself from the mindset of a cult leader? Because this thing, I don't think it has anything to do with education. Critical thinking has a great part of it. I think it has something to do with it. But you find that, like Stanley mentioned earlier, you've already been disarmed when they use most of all these tools on you. So in closing, is there anything, any particular surefire method we can do, maybe for ourselves, for our children?
Okay, I think, like you said, for the children, you should encourage your children to always ask questions. Let them ask at home. The home is the playground. Your home is the experiment space and the crucible. As Africans, most of the time we were told children were to be seen and not to be heard. But these days we need to let our children ask all the questions. There is no ridiculous question. There is no stupid question. Ask all the wise. And when you don't know, be honest and own up and say, I don't know. I will find out. Let's research it together. I think that's very important, especially for the children. Let them be able to ask questions.
Yeah, I think I did mention it. It's the same thing that Morinike just said now. It's about, like we said, it starts from the home where you have to allow people to ask questions. And as I mentioned earlier, if you go into an environment or a platform or an in-group or a club and they say you can't ask questions, then there's a signal here that says, look, I don't think I have to be here. So you need to be able to ask. And the Bible actually encourages us to ask. It said, ask and you shall receive. So when you go to a place and say, ask, you shouldn't ask, just shut up, then that means, come, I don't have to be here. So we need to encourage our kids, encourage our friends and families to always seek other opinions, to also rely on people they trust and have confidence with. But sometimes too, you have people you have confidence with and trust that can also mislead you, you know, sometimes. So we have to always ask, because sometimes trust could be betrayed. And some people, you see them just carried into all this place. So it's that question of questioning. And through those questioning, we'll get answers and we'll know the truth. So I totally support what Morinike said. We have to look at from the home to start encouraging our children to become more critical thinkers.
And on that note, we have come to the end of yet another episode of Real Talk Extra. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you at the next reel. Have a good one, everybody. Thank you for great conversation.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Real Talk Extra. That's R-E-E-L Talk Extra. Do us a solid and follow us everywhere that you listen to your podcast. We love feedback, so you can send us an email at podcast@realtalkextra.com, or you can send us a WhatsApp message, and the number is +1 919 283 6448. That's WhatsApp only. Thanks once again for spending this time with us, and we will see you at the next reel.